It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You say fat, and the cringing begins. Say butter, pan juices, everything changes. Too much of a good thing may be glorious and unhealthy, but a little of a great thing can satisfy big time. Example, melt a stick of butter with some bruised spices, cinnamon, allspice, pepper, cloves. Cook it until it's fragrant, strain it, 3 tablespoons of that over a bowl of potatoes or parsnips, feed 6. Roasting a chicken, great pan juices, spoon up some of those pan juices and toss them with your salad. Terrific. Stick around, there's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Ask the man with one of the bravest palates in the country, he eats tarantulas for fun, to be interviewed by the culinary investigative reporter who loves honing techniques, and what do you get? Well, you get Chef Andrew Zimmern of the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods America with Michael Ruhlman, whose latest book is The Book of Schmaltz.
Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Michael.
I want to talk to you about schmaltz, my love. I'm a goy. I'm a wasp, and you come from a Jewish background. Did you have any experience with schmaltz when you were growing up?
I did, and you know, so few non-Jews really get it. My parents divorced when I was 6 years old, and my grandmother was a force of nature. She had a teeny tiny New York City pre-war apartment that was smaller than the table that I'm sitting at, and the only place to put a 6, 7, 8-year-old boy who was wild and crazy like I was and keep an eye on them while she was cooking was to put me on a little chair at the end of her kitchen by the open window, and I would reach and pass her things and she would cook. I'd usually do a sleepover twice a month with my grandmother on a Saturday night, go over there, sleep over, and then Sunday morning we'd get up and she'd cook all day, and my father and his brother and all my cousins would fill up the house at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I'd go home with my dad. And my grandmother kept 3 or 4 different types of fat in the house at all times, the most cooked with version being chicken fat. And her schmaltz, you know, she did it, you know, old school style with the onions, you know, making grievous. I mean, this woman was in a way, an impossible human being. She was good at really only 2 things. One was canasta. The other one was cooking. And she had the gift. People would taste her food, whether it was the, you know, her pickled tongue, her chopped chicken liver, her matzo ball soup, her roast chickens. I mean, these are her recipes are the ones that I still cook today. And I learned how to cook essentially hanging on to her apron strings. And when I think of her, I smell chicken fat in her apron because she would always wipe her hands. And she was about 6'1", 6'2", a very big woman. And when I was little, my face was right in the place in her apron where there were big, brown, splotchy, greasy leftovers of chicken fat. And to this day, I can't smell real schmaltz cooking without thinking of my grandmother.
Did you leave schmaltz then as you grew up, as America became fat phobic and anything fat was bad? And did you abandon schmaltz?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, as you know, everyone was, you know, running around wanting to do cuisine mansour, cuisine vapeur. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. everyone was trying to go light, go Mediterranean, almost obsessively eschewing anything that smacked of comfort food. I mean, it's one of the great things about getting older is perspective. And, you know, talking to young cooks, culinarians, writers and stuff like that, and reminding them that our obsession with comfort food was something that, you know, is relatively new. I remember telling my friends that, you know, where'd you go last night for dinner? And I went to Sammy's Romanian in New York, a classic New York hangout where a big tub of schmaltz comes onto your table along with the ingredients to make an egg cream if you so desire. I mean, sort of the place that never stopped lionizing schmaltz. And people would look at me like I was crazy. Like, why would you go there? Why weren't you going to some, you know, Arizona 206 or, you know, JoJo right. had just opened? And I was like, well, I like that, but I still got to go to Sammy's Romanian. I can't stop. I mean, that was a once a week thing for me.
I'm glad to hear that, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on where we are now. Where does schmaltz and unusual cooking fats, unusual ingredients, what place do they have now?
Well, people are cooking, I think, in a healthier, smarter way at home. I think, sadly, in America at the same time, eating well has become a class privilege. But the immediacy of food magazines, food television, touch more people and therefore expose more people to greater number of ideas. I remember 10 years ago when I, you know, left restaurants and left magazines, radio, you know, kind of left everything just to sort of create bizarre foods. I never had people talk to me about animal hearts or animal kidneys. It was rarefied air. Now I get 20 emails a day saying my local butcher shop doesn't carry this product. Where do I get it? I see pictures tagging me on Instagram. I see recipes in Food and Wine magazine for offal. I mean, I think that cooking with fats and cooking with sort of a lust for these traditional foods has helped propel things like schmaltz back into the public consciousness. I mean, you have to remember chicken fat is a key ingredient in everyone's, you know, the hottest food in America right now, which is ramen, right? I mean, it has a liquid seasoning and a tare that includes chicken fat. The Inuit tribes and other Arctic tribes that I've spent time with use 3 or 4 different types of animal fat in their cooking, and they will actually drink an ounce of it at a time to superheat their bodies during the cold weather months, which is how we got attracted to – our bodies need fat. It's – you know, I mean, that's where we get energy from. Fat's not an evil word. Fat is good. My favorite meal in the whole world is porcupine fat grilled over an open fire that I got a chance to eat with the Bushmen of the Kalahari.
What does porcupine fat taste like?
Oh, Michael, if there was one meal I could share with you, it would be porcupine fat. I'm not kidding. These are giant animals. They're 60, 70 pounds. These very, very small tribal peoples in a tiny corner of Botswana will actually crawl through the holes where the porcupine lives, spear them, drag them out by their tails, carry them back to where the boma is, the little cluster of huts where the family members live. The women will take all the quills off and use them for jewelry or for tools and for knitting and for a guide. They use them as a guide to make string because they're hollow. There is no hair in a porcupine. Those quills are the hair, and it gets cold in the desert at night. So it has an inch-thick layer of fat. It's almost like pork belly all around its body with a thin striation of muscle because you need muscle to move those quills. They take the entire thing off like a fatty porcupine-shaped blanket. They just skin the whole thing right off. They boil the meat for like 3 days and make a soup till it's all falling apart. And then they take the bones and use the bones for tools and stuff. But they take the fat. They throw the fat over a beaten-down coal fire, pile more coals on top, and blacken it, char it crisp for about 20 minutes. The inside just gets soft and warm. They take it out, they cut it into squares, and they hand you your square. And I sat there with this in my hand, and I thought, I will never be able to eat this. And because it just the whole process had stunned me. And then I took one bite, and I couldn't stop. It was the most delicious thing that I'd ever eaten. And it's actually the food that I think about the most. You know, it's moments like being in my grandmother's kitchen or eating porcupine fat with the Bushmen of the Kalahari that I can't possibly ever have again, and it kills me. Fat's used all over the world, and it's an incredible vehicle for creating other flavors and bringing other flavors into the pan. I think it's vastly overlooked.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Michael.
And thank you for connecting grilled porcupine fat in Botswana with your grandmother's schmaltz on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
It's the same thing.
Exactly. It's the same thing.
You got it.
Andrew Zimmern is host of Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel. Food writer Michael Ruhlman is author of the Book of Schmaltz. And they have both left us recipes. From Andrew, we have butterfried chicken. And from Michael, we have how to do your own homemade schmaltz. And the recipes are on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, I completely agree with Andrew. Fat is the great multitasker in the kitchen. I mean, you get flavor, you get texture, it transfers heat in cooking, it does miracles in baking, and using an old French technique, it preserves. Bon Appetit magazine channeled that mindset. Editor-in-chief Adam Rappaport joins us. Adam, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so I took one look at the picture of the duck confit with spicy raisins and said, yeah, we've got to talk about this one. Okay, so why don't you explain what a confit is?
A confit is simply cooking a protein of any sort in fat, often its own fat, whether that's pork, whether that's duck confit and duck fat. I mean, you could also do, a lot of times you'll see like some sort of fish poached in olive oil kind of. That's, I guess you could call that a confit as well.
And it's a really old preserving method originally, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and what's great, you know, with duck confit, once you've sort of cooked it in its fat, it can just stay and submerged in its fat forever, as long as it's refrigerated. So it's a way to sort of make something delicious and then also sort of keep it and keep it preserved.
So what does it actually taste like when you cook something in the fat?
Well, not fatty necessarily, which I think is somewhat of the confusion. I mean, with duck confit, you're confiting the legs. You're not doing the breasts, which are typically, if you go out to a restaurant, they're cooked in nice medium rare and they're crispy on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
The duck confit, you're taking duck legs and basically braising them in duck fat for several hours till they're that amazing fall off the bone, shredded, juicy, tender. And then right before you eat them, you blast them in a really hot oven. So not only are they fall off the bone tender, but they get nice and crispy and crunchy on the outside.
And amazingly lean, if I remember correctly. Which
Yeah, because a lot of the fat is actually left in the pot. What you're left with is the meat. And that's nice and tender. So I mean, I'm not going to say it's not without fat, but like I said, the irony is that you leave the fat in the pan.
Could almost be diet food, but so now your technique. Explain how you guys did this.
This is our food and features editor Carla Lolly Music sort of came up with one day when she was home. Typically, duck confit tells you to go buy a bunch of duck legs. We like Pekin duck, the Long Island ducks. Not too big, not like too gamey. You know, if you buy 6 duck legs. And then they would tell you to buy a bunch of duck fat also to cook the legs in. And duck fat, I mean, it's not cheap. It's about $6 for 7 ounces. And you need a bunch of ounces. So that adds up.
Right.
And Carlo was thinking, wait a minute. I know there's so much fat in duck skin and there's like a jacket of fat around the meat. Why can't I just render that fat and use it to confit the duck? So what she did, she seasoned the duck with salt, pepper, some ginger, some spices, and then when she put it like in a creuset Dutch oven, like 300 degrees, a little bit of water, put the top on, and just let it go for about 2 hours. And next thing you know, all that fat did render, and within a couple hours, the legs were submerged in its own fat. And you don't have to go out and buy all this fat yourself. You essentially make your own duck fat. The fat comes with the legs. It's a bargain. So it poaches itself, and then you cook it for another couple hours. So it's probably the total cooking time, braising time, if you will, is about 4 hours. But it is one of those things you literally put in the oven, turn it on, and, you know, if you have, like, she had, like, 6 legs in a pot. So she, a couple times she had to move them around because they were a little bit piled on top of each other.
Uh-huh.
But there's no, you don't have to do anything. It's cooking itself. And then once it's done, take it out, let it cool. And like I said, you will have the legs submerged in its own fat. And if it's cool out, if it's that time of year and you have a backyard, you can literally just put the top on and put it outside. And as we talked before, it can just rest in its own duck fat for weeks. But let's say you're cooking it the next day. You just take the pot out, remove the legs from the fat, and you can scrape off the fat from the top, but it's okay to have a little bits of fat on top of it. Lay it out on a sheet tray, crank the oven up to 400, and for about 30 minutes, just put it in the oven, skin side up. And within a half hour, it'll be super crispy and bubbling and aromatic and delicious. And like I said, the inside of the legs will be fall apart, barbecue tender. And then we make a little sort of vinegar, sugar, raisin glaze that you just sort of boil on the stove. You kind of throw all these things in a pot and to boil it down until it gets nice and syrupy. And you can sort of glaze the duck legs with that.
Sounds fabulous. And you can also just take a little bit of that meat, right, and pan fry it and go on a sandwich? Or
you can pan fry it. It's also, you know, the French will often do duck confit, sort of shredded duck confit with like a frisée salad. So you have like the rich meat with a nice bracing acidic salad, which is really nice. So like I said, it's just a good way to cook, but this is something you're doing with the richer, fattier meats, you know, the legs, the pork shoulder, the duck, you know, turkey legs, duck legs. You're not doing with turkey breast or duck breast, for instance. It's stuff that you can cook for 4 hours, not the stuff you want to cook for just 5 minutes over high heat.
You have a great technique to have in our back pocket. Thank you, Adam.
You're welcome.
Adam Rappaport is editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. That duck confit with spicy pickled raisins, the recipe is in the October 2013 issue of the magazine. Now, you can find the recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. We'll be back with the beer lover's beer lover, a Cicerone, and mastering the art of Soviet cooking. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know wine sommeliers. They steer you to a good match with your dinner and maybe turn you on to a wine you never would have tried. Well, if you're lucky enough to run into Julia Herz, she does the same thing for you with beer. She is a certified Cicerone. That is the correct title for a beer sommelier. She's also director of the craft beer program for the Brewers Association. Noelle Carter of the LA Times sat down with Julia.
Julia, it's so great to talk to you today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'm curious, what exactly is a Cicerone and what distinguishes a Cicerone from an avid beer lover or a beer sommelier?
Well, a Cicerone is definitely somebody that's interested in an expanded beer journey and experience, and also being an educator of others. It's a certified program, and if you test into the program, there's three levels, and it gets increasingly more difficult throughout the levels. So it's kind of like the beer world's version of a wine sommelier.
So difficult, meaning you have to kind of try and identify different beers or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we at the Brewers Association document 142 beer styles. There's a lot to know out there.
Wow.
It's not just beer history and the ingredients in beer, but it's the process behind brewing, it's tasting and evaluation, it's beer and food pairing, and it's draft systems and maintenance.
It sounds like you've got a dream job. How did you end up where you are?
I do get that a lot, and I feel very honored. I started as a home brewer, and now I get to represent and be the voice for today's small and independent craft brewers. And of the 2,500 breweries today, the majority are smaller producing breweries that are really on the local and regional level, and we're in the middle of a beer renaissance. So what a great job to have to get to talk these men and women up.
Excellent. I'm curious, how long have you been brewing?
Been brewing about 20 years. So
wow.
It's a hobby that, you know, as soon as I was legal, I was ready to go.
That's so cool. Now, you've mentioned that beer is the number one selling beverage in the U.S. Where have you seen the trends in craft brews going? And have you seen anything particularly interesting and exciting?
Yeah, I mean, you have to take the sales of wine and spirits and combine them to basically match the sales of beer. We're a beer-loving nation, first and foremost. And with that now, we have kind of the localization of beer movement and the globalization of beer movement. And on the local level, you've got retailers you can go into. Some are even doing flights or trays of small quantities. You can taste your way through several beer styles. And then on the brewery level, you've got small brewers like taking old-world beer styles, turning them on their ears and giving them a new world twist. And so you've got more malt, more hops, more ingredients, more experimentation going on with our craft brewers today than what we were really seeing from the old world brewing nations. And now the U.S. is the largest beer destination because of what's going on.
So are there any specific regional trends?
Yeah, I mean, beer definitely has terroir, too. So you've got the Pacific Northwest, who's basically supplying about 30% of the world's supply of hops. So Oregon, Washington, California, they're really featuring hops in a lot of the beer styles. You've got the South that's coming into play and altering their laws to make it more advantageous for breweries to actually start and have a better fighting chance as a small business. So you've got styles starting to pop out of the South that are featuring local ingredients like pecans. The brewers are starting to feature their regional ingredients. That's definitely a trend.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, beer has a lot of stereotypes, including that's, you know, a guy's drink and brewing is a men's club. But women are actively involved both in the professional and home brewing end. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, women are home brewing, professionally brewing, running tasting groups, and whereas maybe, say, Gallup would say 22% of women that do drink fermented beverages are drinking beer, I'm going to say that when I personally am at a beer festival or a beer dinner and I look around, I'm seeing such a higher percentage rate for women who are enjoying craft beer. So kind of craft beer is bringing women back to the beverage of beer, and it's frankly being marketed as a beverage that's not gender specific.
So I have to confess, I tried home brewing once and it was a horrible failure. I really didn't know what I was getting into. What would you recommend for someone who's interested in brewing at home?
This is the same as if saying, I want to take up baking or get good at pie making or get good at canning. You know, we've got a cultural shift that's gone on in the U.S., and part of that is getting back to the basics of what we consume. Let's get used to making our own beer. It's legal to do at home. It's a solid hobby with over a million active home brewers, and, you know, there's nothing better than sharing a home brew with your friends and family that you actually made.
Now, I'm curious, what about those kits that you find in the stores or online? Would you recommend a kit?
Kits are a fantastic way to start. That's how I started. Kits keep it simple, too. There's extract brewing, which is kind of where the malts have been distilled down to a liquid, and you don't have to convert the grains and the enzymes in those grains to get your sugars to wake up. So it's a really easy way to do it. And then as you get more advanced, you're going to go to partial grain from the extract brewing, and then you can go to full grain brewing, just like commercial craft brewers do.
Okay. Some of what you said made sense and some of what you said made absolutely no sense. I'm curious. I've noticed that there are, you know, all these craft brewing organizations and clubs out there. Would you recommend getting involved in a club? And do I have to know anything before I join?
You don't have to know anything to start homebrewing or to join a homebrewing club. It's one of the most welcoming communities where people just want to share their information, absolutely. So, you know, there is approximately 1,500 homebrew clubs in the U.S.
Wow.
that are encouraging new members all the time.
Well, I have to say I'm excited, and I think I'm going to try homebrewing one more time.
Well, I encourage it. That's so great to hear, and thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, and I have to say cheers.
Cheers back. Many good beers to you.
Julia Herz is director of the craft beer program for the Brewers Association. Noelle Carter is food writer and test kitchen director at the LA Times and contributes to their food blog, Daily Dish. Now, not to knock drinking beer, but beer does great things for mustard. So try Noelle's recipe for beer caraway mustard. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Michael Stern perform a public service for all of us. Out there in small towns and big cities are anti-chain eateries with good local food that's still made by moms and pops and sons and daughters. The Sterns dedicate their lives to finding them for us and for their site, roadfood.com. Hey, you two. Welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
What's the latest? Where have you been?
We have been eating pizza all around the country and thinking just how different the unique regional styles of pizza are. We're not talking about Neapolitan pizza. We're talking really about American versions of pizza. You know, we in this country have really made pizza our own. For example, you go to Memphis, Tennessee, of all places, and there you can go to a place called Coletta's, where they specialize in barbecue pizza. And it's a nice flatbread with mozzarella cheese, but instead of sausage or pepperoni, it's pulled pork with barbecue sauce on it.
A great invention.
It's a great invention, and it's especially wonderful because there you are eating a pseudo-Italian food served by waitresses with a southern drawl, with Elvis pictures on the wall, by the way. It's a total kind of dissonance that is actually pretty delicious.
And if you're dieting, you can get barbecue salad.
Oh, well.
Which is just a bunch of iceberg lettuce with barbecue on the top of it. It's better than you think. Where else have you found something really intriguing?
Well, you know, we're big boosters of Connecticut pizza, New Haven style in particular. But very specifically, one of the things that we've found in a couple of New Haven pizzerias is mashed potato pizza. Now, that sounds weird if you think of a big heap of mashed potatoes, but it's not that. It's a regular pizza with mozzarella and tomato sauce, but with a thin, thin glaze of mashed potatoes across the top that gets slightly crisp in
that,
the oven.
Yeah, that does get golden brown.
And it's a weird but wonderful combination.
Boy, the Neapolitans are arming the warships. Somebody dragged us screaming to this mashed potato pizza place, and I was thinking, there's no way in the world that this is going to even, you know, have two bites taken out of it.
Four slices later, you decided maybe it wasn't.
Exactly. But yeah, don't forget, as students, you know, we made English muffins with ketchup in a toaster oven and thought this was good pizza.
You got it. And American cheese on it.
Exactly.
You said there's a New Haven-style pizza. What's a New Haven-style pizza?
It's kind of like traditional Neapolitan pizza. What's different is the crust. It tends to be sort of much chewier. I mean, you know, classic Neapolitan pizza, the crust can be kind of elegant. It has a little chew to it, but a New Haven pizza has real chaw to it. I mean, you really work your jaw chewing it. And to those of us who love bread, it's kind of heavenly.
A lot of semolina on the bottom, scorch marks here and there. And then if you go to Stamford, you have the hot oil pizza, which is a regular crust.
Right.
At the Colony Bar and Grill, the sausage is made across the street, and they top the pizza with a red hot oil, sort of like Szechuan cooking oil. Again, something you'd think, well, that's a really bad idea, but the lines out the door in this place, which has been there since the 1930s, will tell you otherwise.
I'm surprised you haven't mentioned Chicago, Michael, because you have such a passion for Chicago. And is
My
there a
hometown.
Hot dog pizza in Chicago?
No, there is. As far as I know, there is blessedly no hot dog pizza in Chicago.
I'm sure there is, Michael.
And, you know, the fact is Chicago did not invent pizza, but I think it's invented more different kinds of pizza than any other place. We all know about Chicago deep dish pizza, maybe souffle pizza. One of the most interesting ones is made by the Chicago Pizza and Oven Grinder Company. They call it a pizza pot pie. And in fact, that's what it is. It's a very deep dish pizza that is served to you upside down. So in fact, it is less like a pizza than it is like a big kind of crusty casserole.
So the toppings on the plate and the bread's on top of it.
Exactly. And it's needless to say, you need utensils to eat this. You don't eat this by the slice like you would a normal pizza.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, its resemblance to a normal pizza is only in the ingredients. It's a wonderful dish.
I like this. Great pizza tour. Guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, for their latest dining picks, check out the website splendidtable.org. Could call Anya von Bremsen the food and travel writer. She covers the world's poshest, most cutting-edge restaurants for glossy magazines. But this wasn't what she was born to. Anya grew up in Moscow, Soviet Moscow, a little girl who dreamed of food in a time and in a place that was a lot like navigating a hall of funhouse mirrors. Nothing was what it seemed. Anya tells her story and rolls out an epic history of Soviet Russia through its food in her Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, a memoir of food and longing. Anya, welcome back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Well, you grew up in Moscow, and your mother had lived through the years of Stalin when it was an incredibly difficult situation. What was the food like when you were growing up? What are the memories of those things?
A lot of what I remember now is just this kind of kitschy, you know, retro institutional food that's very popular. But, you know, we loved it. For instance, we had the pirozhki, the fried pastries on the street, sold by, you know, this horrible scowling women in white coats. We had this big clunky candies, chocolates with names like Cosmos and Glory to October or Mishka the Clumsy Bear. At holiday times, there were cut crystal balls of salad olivier, the iconic Soviet salad of potatoes, pickles, chicken, all, you know, decorated with mayonnaise ribbons. So now it sort of comes across as very endearing. Of course, when that's all you ate, I was just wildly fantasizing about foreign foods, which I've never tried. For instance, Proust's Madeleine.
Yeah.
I remember my mom read me the passages and I was like, what is this Madeleine? We had no idea.
So in 1974, the two of you came to the United States and you came with nothing, really basically nothing. And you went to your first supermarket and you talk in the book about a dark truth that you found there.
It was actually, you know, the biggest culture shock because all our lives we dreamt of abundance. Specifically, we dreamt of America. We imagined, you know, bananas growing on trees. We imagined, you know, a road paved with juicy fruit gum, which in Moscow I black marketeered. All this sort of desired, fantasized about Western foreign goods. And suddenly I enter this huge pathmark in Northeast Philadelphia, super suburban. It was as huge as Red Square. And I see so much food that I feel like I'm buried underneath it. And that was like the crash of my American dream. And everyone was buying it without any fuss. You could get anything you wanted, 20 kinds of salami, sure, you know, peanut butter. My mother was mesmerized by this abundance. But then, you know, she would get Pop-Tarts. Or she would get something horrible like vinegar pickled pig's food. So she would experiment with all this stuff. And I realized then that, oh, American food must be just absolutely horrifying.
So did it ever redeem itself for you? I mean, you are a food writer and you're still here.
Slowly, gradually. I think I actually lost my sense of taste in the first few months of exile. Because, you know, we left with two tiny suitcases without the right of return. You know, this was our new home, whether we liked it or not, you know. And food actually represented to me, you know, the sort of pain of immigrant dislocation. I remember the Christmas, you know, with this black Oreo cookies with something synthetic inside. You know, nothing tasted like I expected it to taste. It took me years, actually, to really, you know, energize myself about food. And also, the American food revolution was happening. So the actual food got much better.
Well, that's true. It's true. Now, what about today? What is it like there now? What is the food like?
The Moscow supermarkets, the glitzier ones, really remind me of like the Depa Chicas in Tokyo, where you have such an incredible array of foodstuffs. And because they can fly anything from Europe, so you have all the Iberico hams from Spain, you know, 12 kinds. You have every farmhouse French cheese. All this like women in Fendi furs talk about the latest burrata. The whole food vocabulary, you know, there are almost no Russian words. Everything, you know, they don't say the Russian word sparja for asparagus. They say asparagus. It's just so ostentatiously consumerist. And there is another wrinkle, Soviet nostalgia. So at GUM department store, the glitzy department store on Red Square, They have a huge Soviet-style supermarket with all those iconic products that we missed when we immigrated. They have this conical juice fountains, Soviet-style ice cream, stewed sauerkraut, all the sort of iconic Soviet foods that, you know, we fled from.
Is this food available to everybody, or is there still that great schism that existed in the Soviet Union between the rich and the poor?
Well, at least there was something equalizing in Soviet times where if you were rich, you were secretly rich. You know, we were a classless society, on paper at least. And now it's much more in your face. But at the same time, anyone can go to a supermarket and afford at least a foreign chocolate. It's just like any other sort of second world economy.
If you could go back and live there, would you?
No, it's a very, at least not in Moscow. My last chapter of the book deals with the kind of deep alienation that I'm wandering around Moscow, a stranger in my own homeland. And it was very ironic because my mom and I were invited to do a TV cooking show in Moscow. So we kind of returned, you know, semi-media characters. And I recorded the cooking show with ex-Kremlin chef on Stalin's old China, which was very, very unsettling. But I don't think I could live there.
Anya, thanks for talking with us.
Great to be here.
Anya von Bremsen has written Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, a memoir of food and longing. Now, the one dish you have to do from the book is the great Russian pastry of seafood, rice, and mushrooms, the kulibiaka. Anya's recipe, it's on the website, splendidtable.org.
We're going to be back with your calls, tweets, and other communiques. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?
It is time to connect with you. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have Gwen on the line from Pakistan. Huh? Gwen, hi. Hello, Gwen.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What are you doing in Pakistan?
I'm here doing research for my doctoral dissertation.
And what's that going to be on?
It's in linguistic anthropology. I'm looking at language and cinema.
Fascinating stuff.
There's a lot of linguistic diversity here. I'm looking at actually one of the biggest languages, which is Punjabi, but there are dozens and dozens of languages in Pakistan, and not a lot of work being done either, which is a shame because it's such an interesting place.
Ah, must be fascinating. So you had a question?
Yeah, so there are so many amazing, amazing fruits, including a lot of ones that I haven't really ever had anything to do with before.
Right, right.
And I was hoping to talk to you about this one fruit called jamun, which I've never seen in the States. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
The name is vaguely familiar.
I think that they're called Java plums someplace. I think maybe it's originally from Indonesia, but they're this like black kind of largish berry, like purple black.
Right.
And on the inside, there's this big white seed. And they've got this taste that's sort of like in between like a grape and a blackberry. And they're super good. And they grow on trees everywhere. And mostly people just eat them, you know, just
straight,
just plain, or maybe with
right.
a little salt.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm really hoping to experiment with cooking them somehow. And the only real obstacle I can think of is this huge seed. It doesn't like easily pop out. And the seed itself has a really astringent kind of taste.
Right. You know what I think? I know now where I've heard of it. In Indian food. It's very popular.
Yeah, in India as well.
Yeah. Okay, cooking with it. It's sweet, and it tastes like a cross between a plum and a grape?
Yeah, like it was like a blackberry flavor as well.
Okay.
Like it's not really tart, but when
right.
you get to the seed, like the outside fruit is really sweet and mild, and then the seed part is more like tangy and astringent.
And seeding, it's going to be a royal pain, I gather.
Yeah, I guess I could, but the amount that I could get off the seed, it would take a really long time.
Have you ever tried adding it to a curry? You know, to a stew, a sauce?
I haven't.
Because what I'm thinking is, wherever tamarind might be used, you could probably try, I mean, it's not going to be as sour, but this would be really interesting. And I'm thinking of dishes like things with yogurt sauce, where you would add this at the very end, so you get the bright taste of the fruit with the yogurt. I'm remembering a dish, and I don't remember where it's from, but it's lentil flour that is spiced, and it's fried in little balls, and then it's placed you know the dish? In a sea of yogurt with droplets of tamarind.
Yeah,
and fresh coriander. Okay, then what you want to do is, instead of those droplets of tamarind, you do the fruit. And you crush it lightly, but, you know, you do pools of it. It's got to be, I'm sorry, my mouth is starting to water. Boy, would that be good, wouldn't it?
That would be really tasty.
That would be really, really fabulous. And by the way, for everyone who's listening, please say the name of the dish again, because I've seen it in cookbooks.
Dahi bhalle. It would be like D-A-H-I, dahi, which is yogurt.
Oh, I see.
And then bhalle, B-H-A-L-L-E, which is the little fried lentil cake.
Okay. Yes, I remember eating this and just losing my mind. And I think it's a perfect place for it.
Yes. Yeah,
and then think of it in other places where you want to have an accent of fruit, where you would drop it into something that you're slow simmering. That would be great. And think of it in a chutney.
Ooh, yeah. Actually, maybe like with tomato or something.
Yeah. And maybe some fresh ginger to complement it. I think that could really be interesting. Give it a try.
I was also wondering about maybe maybe making preserves with it. I've never made preserves before, and I don't know if like I can get pectin very easily.
Well, you don't know. You may not need pectin if it's a berry. And the idea is with a preserve is you're using the whole fruit. The seed may pose a problem, but do people eat it whole and eat the seed?
No, you spit out the seed. But I was thinking maybe if I like strained it somehow or mashed it.
This is the classic way to make a jam. You take equal poundage of the fruit and sugar. Now, I could cut back that sugar by at least 25%.
Okay.
You need it, though, for the preserving. And you toss that together and let it sit overnight in a strainer, okay, because a lot of juice will eke out. You start boiling that juice. You then could strain the fruit, like using a food mill or whatever, into that with the rest of the sugar. And you could throw spices in there if you want. But the point is you simmer that until, on a cold plate, it begins to hold its own shape. And that's not a super long time. And then you need sterile jars. You put it in sterile jars. But probably the best idea is make small quantities. Put it in jars that you've boiled. But put it in the fridge. Don't try to keep it for months. Use it in a week or two.
Sure, sure.
And then you can make a little bit more.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think you're going to have a ball with this. Oh, boy, I wish it grew here.
Yeah, I think it might grow in Florida. I was looking it up online.
Hey, enjoy the fascinating work and enjoy the fruit. Thank you, Gwen.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye. Sissy's on the line from Dallas. Hey, Sissy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I need some help.
I am here for you.
Great. I have some recipes in multiple formats. Some are printed on copy paper. Others are jotted down on random scraps of paper. And some are on index cards, none of which are the same size. You know how that goes.
This sounds like my life. Yes. Okay.
Some of the index cards also have writing on the front and the back of them. Some of them are also handwritten, and they have sentimental value, so I don't want to just retype them.
I understand.
What's a good way to organize these recipes?
Well, it sounds like you've got, are these from the family?
Yes, they are, the family recipes.
Oh, boy. You know what might be fun to do? Keep all the originals, but do a scan of each piece, both sides when needed. You know, scan one side, then scan the other. The idea is, why not turn it into a book? So even if it's a loose leaf thing, it could be beautifully done. You could use great quality paper. You could lay these pieces out. I mean, usually the easiest way for all of us to use recipes is, you know, to start with hors d'oeuvres or whatever, and then soup, and then salad, and then, you know, the meat, the fish, whatever. In so many words, lay the recipes out as though it's a regular cookbook. But what I'm imagining is some wonderful paper, maybe in color, maybe it has a texture, and you have cut out these scanned pieces, and you have laid them on that paper, maybe at angles. You can write in between them with any stories you remember that are attached to them.
Okay.
And this becomes a single copy, but this is also the kind of thing can easily then be reproduced for the entire family. And
that's a great idea.
Yeah, it would be a lovely thing, and by Christmas you'd have something that'd be a great gift for everybody.
Christmas solved. That would be great.
Well, not only that, but solved with one thing that you just have to have somebody just throw together multiples of. It could be great.
That's a great solution.
Yeah, and if you have photos of the dish or photos of the people who were involved with the dish. So you've got, you know, the story of the family.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I think you'll have a ball with it.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, Sissy, I think this is something other people are going to pick up on. Thanks for asking the question.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252 is how you can reach us, and you can send us an email. You go to splendidtable.org. And, of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter. You know how Southern food is center stage right now. You know, there's a group of young chefs who are digging into old tastes and nearly extinct plants that made them possible. Well, we hear about the cooks, but we rarely hear about the two men who stand behind those cooks. Glenn Roberts and Dr. David Shields hunt those supposedly lost melons and rices and beans, and they plant them to save their flavors, their genes, and their traditions. Glenn Roberts is founder of Anson Mills. Dr. David Shields is professor of Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina. Glenn, David, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Yes, it's wonderful.
So tell me what you two are up to. What are you doing?
We are trying to bring back into the fields of the United States the greatest plants that were available in terms of classic American cuisine and particularly in terms of Southern cuisine.
Are these basically almost extinct? I mean, I've heard that there are things that you just can't bring back because they no longer exist.
That's true. There are quite a number of things, particularly in terms of strawberries and fruits, that have been lost forever. But a surprising number of things have survived. You know, if something is truly good, someone somewhere who's a true believer will keep it going in their family garden for generations.
So, Glenn, what kinds of things are you working with? What have you discovered so far?
Well, you have to think about prowling around in the countryside the way I do it and finding things that used to be on the table that have gone feral and bringing them back. This is true with sea island red peas, the cowpeas of our area.
Mm-hmm.
You go poking around the woods and they're still out there wild occasionally, and you bring them back and redomesticate them.
What do they taste
in
like?
The case, oh, the massive amounts of deep, rich, meaty flavors with lots of minerality. Some of them have the moniker iron peas for that very reason. And they draw you in. It's the classic Southern red gravy pea.
So some of the other foods that you've brought back already.
We have discovered within the last year the ancestral peanut of the South, the Carolina African runner peanut, which was thought to have been extinct in the 1950s, but this was the first one brought by the slaves from West Africa in the 17th century and maintained in the freezer of a peanut breeder from North Carolina State University, collected sometime in the 1920s or 30s.
Oh, my goodness. So you found it in an old freezer?
Well, I didn't actually go into the freezer myself. Over a phone call, I asked if he had this thing there, and he checked his card catalog and said, well, I have a Carolina number 4 and a Carolina number 8. And I nearly dropped out of my chair when he said that. We'd been looking for 5 years for this.
Oh, my. Glenn, are these plants perhaps going to be plants that are going to be side-by-side with commercially grown produce?
That's a great question. I think that the stress tolerance, which is a nice way to say that, is built into all these very old, what we call heirloom heritage, and probably more specifically land race, all one word, means farmer improved. They have a lot of stress tolerance built into them. They'll take a drought. They'll take too much rain. They'll take a freeze. The Bradford melon that David's been working on for 2.5 years with the Bradford family, they made their melons while our governor was declaring a disaster for South Carolina agriculture. Those melons were tolerant of all this rain, where most of the melons exploded in the field elsewhere.
Wow. It seems between the locavore movement, the concerns over biodiversity, and then the fact there are so many Southern chefs who have become, if you know, hot, it just seems everything has come together, the perfect storm, so to speak.
I think there's a great sympathy, and one of the things that we really look forward to is when the home cook embraces what they've tasted out in the restaurant and starts looking for these ingredients. I think a lot of people want to participate, and there is something about growing food yourself, knowing that it is the right seed, that the soil has been treated well, that it isn't just a supplementation of chemicals on it,
right,
but the actual taste of the place that you're putting into your mouth. That's really important.
Oh. David Shields, Glenn Roberts, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, and thank you for having us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Dr. David Shields is McClintock Professor of Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina. Glenn Roberts is founder of Anson Mills. Now, for information on their work, go to the website splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for listening in. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Mark Twain. Watermelon is chief of this world's luxuries. When one has tasted it, he knows what angels eat. It was not southern watermelon that Eve took. We know it because she repented. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you're ever going to need. And if you like what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. You can listen anytime it's convenient for you. The Splendid Table team is made up of senior producer Jennifer Russell and production assistant Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Stu Newman. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.